what it is, hon.
Okay. We're going to be discussing tonight the two kingdoms reunited, the gospel of the kingdom. All right. So again, I'm going to start this whole thing off with, don't believe anything I say, verify everything I say. Because we always need to check out the scriptures to see if something is true. All right? That's our final authority right here. And not just the beginning or the end, the whole thing. Okay? So, what is the gospel of the kingdom? And I think anybody that was at Sukkot this year, I kind of did a little teaching on the gospel of the kingdom. And hopefully you remember that. But we're going to begin with the verse Matthew 24:14, where Yeshua, the master, says, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." So it's really interesting to try to figure out what this gospel of the kingdom that the Messiah was preaching. Now, probably a lot of you here have an idea of what the gospel is. I know in the church circles that I used to hang out in, they had an idea of what the gospel was. Anybody have a comment on that? What was the gospel we were told when we were in church? Yeah, the death, burial, and resurrection of the Messiah. Okay, that's kind of it in a nutshell. Well, that's not what the Messiah taught. Otherwise, his disciples, after his death and burial, would have been going, yeah, look at this, it's fallen all into place just like he said. But what did they do? They said, well, jig's up, boys, it's time to go fishing. It's all over, we're all done. So if that was the gospel, why wouldn't he have informed his 12 closest disciples, 11 I guess, that this was something to look forward to? So really, to understand this gospel of the kingdom idea, we need to do a little bit of history background. And this, Daniel, how you doing, man? She'll have to edit this out, but that's okay.
Let's keep going.
Okay. All right, why would there need to be a good news for a kingdom? Because gospel basically means good news, all right? Kind of a fancied up Christian word we like to use, but it really means good news. So what really is the good news of the kingdom? So let's look at prophecy of the future division of the house of Israel. So if anybody wants to turn to Deuteronomy 31... we'll all go there, because again, we're going to take this strictly out of the Word. Deuteronomy 31, 16 to 29. Now, what we have to understand here, in Deuteronomy 16, this is, or 31, I'm sorry, this is where Moshe is preparing Israel to enter into the kingdom of Israel. Okay, of course it's Canaan at this point, but it's going to become Israel. So what we have here is a prophecy, even before they enter, of what's going to take place. So I'll start in 16, Deuteronomy 31, 16. "And Jehovah said to Moses, behold, you will rest with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land, that where they go to be among them. And they will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them. And I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, have not these evils come upon us because our Elohim is not among us? And I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they have done, and that they have turned to other gods. Now therefore, write down this song for yourselves and teach it to the children of Israel. Put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel." So this is kind of interesting. This is before they even go in the land. And God's telling them through Moses that you guys are going to mess this thing up, even before they get in. and that they're going to be punished and they're going to be kicked out. And God is going to forsake them because they've entered into a covenant with him and they're going to turn from that covenant. Okay? So we have a prophecy of what's going to take place. And I find this interesting because I get a lot of people that also, they're a little bit against Israel as it stands right now in the land. The 1948, when Israel went in, I hear all kinds of conspiracy people say, they're not real Israelites. They really shouldn't be in there. Man put them in there. It's all a lot of nonsense. But if you understand the historical background, for them to get in there, it's a miracle. Mm-hmm. God is behind that. And the answer they'll say is, well, look at what a mess Israel is. They're as secular as any other country in the world. And yes, they are. It's terrible what's going on. But guess what? He brings them into the promised land way back here in Moses' time, and he knew they weren't going to keep his commandments. Yet he allows them into his land because he's merciful. And there are some that do keep his covenant to the best of their ability.
Always a remnant.
So, 1948, just because they're not keeping the commandments the way we maybe think they should be, doesn't by any means alter that God is the one that put them in there. Because he's already done that pattern in the past. Mm-hmm. Even though he knew they were going to mess up. So that gives me hope. Because listen, we don't do everything right either. Mm-hmm. And he's merciful to us. He allows us back in the covenant. And he allows us time to grow into it. So we have this prophecy then. Now, let's look at this prophecy fulfilled. So we're going to go to 1 Kings chapter 11. This is a historical event that happened. Now, this actually, and we could read all this, but we're going to be here all night, because it actually runs from chapter 11 all the way to chapter 14. But what I'm going to do is I'll hit on some highlights and the key points of historical interest here, okay? So what we have background, we have King Solomon taking over for his father David as king of Jerusalem and king of Israel. All right. Now this is when we have all 12 tribes all under one king in Israel. All right. Now we have some problems with Solomon though, which always floored me because he's the wisest man who ever was. And yet he has a downfall. And what is that? You got it. Women is a problem. We have this same pattern all the way through the scriptures. Genesis chapter 6 is all about God's men who follow the Torah, men who follow the commandments, called righteous, called sons of God, who take wives of foreign gods, and it corrupts them. We have the same problem here with Solomon. Solomon takes on these wives. He even builds temples for them in Jerusalem, which is a huge problem. So God doesn't look kindly on these things. So what does God do? He actually brings up an adversary who is actually a servant of Solomon, and his name is Jeroboam. And that's in verse 26. So we've kind of covered his sin, which is the women. Verse 26 in chapter 11 says, "And Solomon's servant, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite from Zerada, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow who rebelled against the king." So we've got a guy whose mother was rebellious against the king. What do you think he's going to be like? Probably a little bit rebellious. So, and Jeroboam, it's interesting to note that he is an Ephraimite. Okay, so he's from the tribe of Ephraim. Mm-hmm. All right? Which is probably what a lot of us
which
are.
Which is going to end up to be the northern.
Yeah. And so what we have here is Jeroboam, he ends up, he's a mighty man of valor. And Solomon, seeing that the young man was industrious, made him the officer over all the labor force of the house of Joseph. Now it happened at the time, I'm verse 29, when Jeroboam went out to Jerusalem And the prophet Ahijah, the Shilamite, met him on the way, and he had clothed himself in a new garment, and the two were alone in the field. And Ahijah took hold of the new garment that was on him, and he tore it into 12 pieces. Again, numbers are important. 12 pieces always represents the 12 tribes, correct? We can usually make that assumption. So, and he said to Jeroboam, "Take for yourselves 10 pieces, for thus says Jehovah, Elohim of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon, and I will give 10 tribes to you. But he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, because they have forsaken me and worship Ashtoreth," which is Easter, by the way, "the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Malcolm, the god of the people of Ammon, and have not walked in my ways to do what was right in my eyes and keep my statutes and my judgments as did his father David. However, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand because I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose because he kept my commandments and my statutes." So you see with Yah, when he makes a covenant with somebody, he has to keep it. Even though Judah, the tribe of Judah, was doing things out of line as well, he could not dispel them because of the promises he made with David. He has to keep that going. So he's tearing the northern 10 tribes away from Solomon and giving them to King Jeroboam. So we'll move on here. Now we're going to find out that there's some enmity between these two houses, because after Solomon loses his kingdom, part to Jeroboam, his son Rehoboam takes over the southern part of the kingdom. Okay? So now Rehoboam is a young king, and he's a little rash. And what he does is, I'll just sort of summarize chapter 12 here, is he ends up going to his father's counselors and says that, you know, my father, Solomon, taxed the whole kingdom. And it was a fairly heavy tax from what I understand. And his counselors said, listen, they're a little uneasy right now. You should ease up on the taxes. And so he goes to his young counselors, guys his age. And they said, no, no, no. If your father was hard on him, you should be doubly hard. And he takes their counsel. So what happens is the northern 10 tribes say, listen, we're not going to put up with this high taxation. We're done with you guys. We're leaving. And so they do. So we have the split of the nation of Israel into two houses. We have the southern tribes, which is Judah, Benjamin, and some Levites. And then we have the northern tribes, which is the other 10. Okay? So this is the breakup. This is what is prophesied all the way through Scripture as well. Okay? So we have this idea of two houses. Now, on this little map here, we show Jerusalem and Solomon's kingdom, the size of it. Basically, it's the whole area. And then we have, after the divided kingdom, we have Israel to the north, Judah to the south. And there's a little extra map in there because it's coming up to Hanukkah soon. Is the size of it during the Maccabean time. Yeah. All right. And if you're having Hanukkah, we can explain why that's an important time as well. But not for tonight. So, the reign of Jeroboam lasted from 853 AD to 841 AD. So, it's not a really long reign, but he made a lot of issues there. I want to quick go to 1 Kings 14. And this, I like to ask this question from people. Who is the most wicked man in Scripture?
Jeroboam.
You got it. Jeroboam. And it's funny because you know this story, so you kind of got ahead. But most people that have never heard this, they think, you know, maybe Judas Iscariot, or they'll pick Nebuchadnezzar, or one of those pagan kings that was actually quite evil anyways. But in God's eyes, Jeroboam is the most evil one who ever lived. So let's read about him just a little bit here. And it's 1 Kings 14. And it's verse 7 I'll begin at. And he says, "Go tell Jeroboam, thus says Jehovah Elohim of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people and made you ruler over all my people Israel," northern 10 tribes, "and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, and yet you have not been as my servant David, who kept my commandments and who followed me with all of his heart, to do only what was right in my eyes. But you have done more evil than all who were before you. For you have gone and made for yourself other gods and molded images to provoke me to anger and have cast me behind your back." Now, does everybody know what Jeroboam did when he took the northern 10 tribes and broke off from Israel?
He made two altars and put two golden calf on the shoulder.
Dan and Bethel is where those worship places were.
And also he make his appointed days, his own priest, now Levi, not by the law, it's by his own. I think he kind of twisted
did.
Somehow.
He did.
And until this day, Chinese people still keep the 8th month and 15 days.
Really?
Yes.
That's interesting.
And it's scary.
So like John said, I'll just reiterate so they can catch all this. What happened with Jeroboam is he set up two golden calves. One in Dan and one in Bethel. He changed the feast days from God's feast days of Leviticus 23 to something else. He changed the priesthood from the Levitical priesthood to his own priests. And he changed the place of worship from Jerusalem to Dan or Bethel. So if we look forward to Constantine, what did Constantine do? He changed the place of worship from Jerusalem to Rome. He changed the feast days from the Leviticus 23 feast days to Christmas, Easter, Lent, whatever, all those other pagan ones, right? He changed the priesthood from the Levites to whoever priests he wanted. Okay? So we have that spirit of Jeroboam all over Constantine. Now the problem is, and we realize this, is the church hasn't looked back. They followed Constantine's edict all the way through history and not looked back. So if that's what got Jeroboam into so much trouble and gave him the title of being the most wicked man who ever was, we have a real problem with the system of religion we've been handed down. So, just bring that to play. So this is, again, why we have such an issue with the northern 10 tribes. They're in serious trouble. Does anybody know what God did to them? The northern 10 tribes? Because of Jeroboam? He scattered them, yes, but he also did something else. He divorced them. Exactly. Because God is like a husband to Israel. And it mentions that all the way through Scripture as well. So we're going to check out this whole divorce idea. And that comes from right from the Torah, right from the law. And we're going to go to Deuteronomy chapter 24, 1 to 4. Now keep this all in mind, because this is all going to play back with the gospel of the kingdom when we get to Yeshua's time. Hopefully we can make this run full circle.
Say also keep that in mind when you read Paul's letter. Mm-hmm. You won't understand unless you understand this one. Mm-hmm.
That's right. You have to understand this, because this is where this is actually the mystery Paul's talking about.
Mystery of the kingdom.
But we're going to go back to the Torah, where we find our law basis for everything that's going to happen here, which is Deuteronomy chapter 24, 1 to 4. Everybody there? I'll have a sip. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanliness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. When she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies, who took her as his wife, when the former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before Jehovah, and you shall not bring sin on the land which Jehovah Elohim is giving you as an inheritance. So basically what this is saying is, if she marries a man and the man finds some uncleanness in her, gives her a divorce, because divorce is allowed in God's eyes. It's not what he wants, but he makes provision for it. But it has to be done legally. A legal divorce, you need to give her a certificate that says she's no longer bound to the marriage and send her away. When Yeshua is having an issue in the New Testament, the Brit Hadashah, with the divorce problem, what was happening is men were finding a problem with their wives and just sending them away, not giving them the certificate.
So they're shamed.
So when they would go to be with another man, they're still legally married, which would be adultery. Right? Mm-hmm. But it was to shame her. So husbands were being critical and mean to their wives and not giving them the ability to remarry. And that's what the certificate is all about. Yes, John?
They're still doing that today.
They are still doing that today. But you see, yeah, Yeshua is trying to explain. He says, that's not God's original plan. But guess what? He makes provision for it. So if you're just sending your wife out, then she's stuck. She has no way to support herself. She has no means to remarry. So she's destitute. So Yeshua's going, this shouldn't happen. You need to write her a certificate so she can remarry. And because in those days, the woman just didn't go out and get a job. Right? It didn't work that way. She would be in serious trouble without having a husband or a father or somebody to help her sustain herself. So this is a big problem. So if she's sent away by that husband and she does find another husband and she's with him and he divorces her or he dies, she cannot return to the original husband. Okay?
That's what this law is saying.
So we have a really huge problem with God divorcing the northern 10 tribes. And we're going to talk a little bit about all the scriptures that say he will not completely forsake them. Right? Because we got a problem here. If he's divorced Israel and he says all of Israel will be saved, we got a dilemma here. He's going against his own law, and God cannot do that. The whole universe will implode if that happens. So we have to find a remedy for this situation of this divorce group that is supposed to be God's chosen people. So we'll kind of carry on here. Let's look at the scriptural confirmation of this divorce. Okay, it's Isaiah 50, 1 and 2. So hopefully everybody's tracking here. We have Israel, northern tribes, going off the rails, getting divorced after going into adultery. And this is confirmation of that. Isaiah 50, 1 and 2. Thus says Jehovah, where is the certificate of your mother's divorce whom I have put away? Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? For your iniquities you have sold yourselves, and for your transgressions your mother has been put away. So that's one spot. And again, the context of that is he's speaking to the northern 10 tribes. So let's go to Jeremiah 3, 1 to 8 as well. Because we always need more than one witness. Jeremiah 3, 1 to 8. Everybody there? They say, if a man divorces his wife and he goes from, and she goes from him and becomes another man's, may he return to her again? Would not the land be greatly polluted? But you have played the harlot with many lovers. Yet return to me, says Jehovah. Lift up your eyes to the desolate heights and see, where have you not lain with men? By the road you have sat for them, like a Arabian in the wilderness, and you have polluted the land with your harlotries and your wickedness. Therefore, the showers have been withheld, and there has been no latter rain. You have had a harlot's forehead. You refuse to be ashamed. You will not from this time cry to me, my father. You are the guide of my youth. Will you remain angry forever? Will he keep it to the end? Behold, you have spoken and done evil things as you were able. And Jehovah said to me, in the days of Joshua, the king, have you seen what backsliding Israel has done? She has gone up on every high mountain and under every green tree and has played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all these things, return to me. But she did not return, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. Then I saw that for all the causes for which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a certificate of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but went and played the harlot also. So again, we have an issue with Judah. He can't divorce Judah. Because who's going to come from that line?
Messiah.
The Messiah. So again, there's things that he can and won't do. But the northern 10 tribes, because of their adulteries, he gives them a certificate of divorce. And one more reference for that is Hosea 2. Hosea 2. 1 to 13. Say to your brethren, my people, and to your sisters, mercy is shown. Bring charges against your mother, bring charges, for she is not my wife, nor am I her husband. Let her put away her harlotries from her sight, and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and expose her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. I will not have mercy on her children, for they are the children of harlotry. For their mother has played the harlot. She has conceived them and has behaved shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up your way with thorns and wall her in so she cannot find her paths. She will chase her lovers, but not overtake them. Yes, she will seek them, but not find them. Then she will say, I will go and return to my first husband. For then it was better for me than now. For she did not know that I gave her grain, new wine and oil, and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. So the things God gave them, they gave to foreign gods. But as you can see, she wants to return. But as we know from Deuteronomy, she can't. So we have a dilemma here. So is this law in verse 24, in Deuteronomy 24, a contradiction? We have a big problem because Yah has already told Jacob that he was going to make a nation of him. And those northern 10 tribes are part of Jacob, correct? That's in Genesis 35. We'll go back to Genesis 35. 9 to 12. And God appeared to Jacob again when he had came from Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. So he called his name Israel. Also Elohim said to him, I am Elohim Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I give to you and your descendants. After you, I give this land. And Elohim went up from him in that place where he talked with him. So we see this promise. to Jacob, who is actually Israel, the whole 12 tribes embodied in him, that they would inherit the land. Well, that promise can't happen as long as these guys are divorced, because they've been kicked out of the land. So we have an issue. So we're going to look at a few scriptures here, and I wrote a whole bunch of them down, but we don't have to cover them all for lack of time. But these are confirming Yah's covenant with Israel, and it is forever. So again, without understanding this mystery that Paul is going to reveal later on, we're at a loss here. So let's just check out a couple of them. Deuteronomy 4:31 is one. And go through these, because you know what? You can't have too much scripture to back up these things. It just helps solidify them.
This helps debunk the replacement theology that you get a lot from people coming out of churches. Oh, well, we're the church now. We've replaced Israel. Well, this will get rid of that.
Yeah, that kind of fixes that whole issue. Deuteronomy 4:31 says, "For Jehovah your Elohim is a merciful God. He will not forsake you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers, which he swore to them." Now, I kind of shortened that up a little bit, but basically he's speaking to Israel, the entire nation of Israel. And so he's saying this covenant he will not forget that he swore with their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Deuteronomy 30:1-10 is another one. This is actually one of my favorite chapters here. Because earlier in 29, we go through, and 28, we go through all the blessings for keeping the covenant. And if you don't keep the covenant, he goes through all the curses. And by the way, there's more curses than there is blessings. There's 97 curses in that section. Which is, so when you're a covenantal person and you enter into that covenant with Yah, he's serious about you keeping it. Because all those curses are coming if you decide, you know what, I'm not thinking that's too important. Okay, can get dangerous. So anyways, but 30 talks about what happens when you understand you've broken those things and you repent and return. "Now it shall come to pass when all these things come upon you, the blessings and the curses which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where Jehovah your Elohim drives you." Does this not sound like the scattered ones, John? Because not only did the northern 10 tribes get scattered, Judah also gets scattered at one point. Not for as long, but they too get scattered. So what he's saying is, one day you're going to wake up and go, gee, what just happened? Mm-hmm. Things aren't going like God said they should. What's the problem here? "So, and you return to Jehovah your Elohim and obey his voice according to all that I command you today, you and your children, with all of your heart and with all of your soul." I think there's people in this room that had this thing happen to them.
Yep.
"That Jehovah your Elohim will bring you back from captivity and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where Jehovah your Elohim has scattered you. If any of you are driven out to the farthest parts under heaven, like Canada, from there Jehovah your Elohim will gather you, and from there he will bring you. Then Jehovah your Elohim will bring you to the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. He shall prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers. And Jehovah your Elohim will circumcise your hearts and the heart of your descendants to love Jehovah your Elohim with all of your heart and with all of your soul, that you may live. Also, Jehovah your Elohim will put all these curses on your enemies and on those who hate you, who persecuted you. And you will again obey the voice of Jehovah and do all his commandments, which I command you today. Jehovah your Elohim will make you abound in all the work of your hand and the fruit of your body, in the increase of your livestock, in the produce of the land for good. For Jehovah will again rejoice over you for good, as he rejoiced over your fathers. If," there's that big if word, "you obey the voice of Jehovah Elohim to keep his commandments his statutes, which are written in this book of the law. And if you turn to Yehovah Elohim with all of your heart and with all of your soul. I just love that section. That's the gospel right there, by the way. The gospel is repenting, returning to the Father, and he restores you to the position that we're supposed to take. Okay? Now, I've got all kinds of scriptures in here, all through Leviticus, Nehemiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and they all refer to him never giving up on his covenant with Israel. He does talk about forsaking them for a time. But guess what? He's going to have a remedy for that. And we'll get to that shortly here. Yah's covenant with Abraham, while Abraham was asleep, is an important part of this whole process. Because if he would have made a covenant with Abraham personally, what's the problem with that? We don't tend to keep covenants very well. So when Abraham is making that covenant with Yah, guess what he does? He puts Abraham to sleep. And he makes that covenant with himself. And he can't break that. This is why God is a God of covenants, and it all goes back to the one he made with Abraham. This is why any of us are even here tonight, is that covenant with Abraham. If it wouldn't have been for that, we'd all have been destroyed a long time ago. So, we see this covenant. And we'll go back to that. It's Genesis 15. Everybody there? 15, 12 to 21. Now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, horror and great darkness fell upon him. And he said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge afterward, and they shall come out with great possession. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age." Oh, I got to keep going. "But in the fourth generation, they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. And it came to pass, when the sun went down and it was dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between the pieces." These are the pieces of the animals Abraham had cut to cut this covenant. Because in a covenant, it always means death if you break it. That's what this is all about. This is the covenant of the pieces God made with Abraham. They would cut the animals in half and they would walk through the pieces. They actually said it was like a figure eight because it's continuous. So what would happen is if one of them broke that covenant, what happens to you, what happens to those animals? You die. So God did not make that covenant with Abraham. He was asleep. It's for Abraham. He made it with himself. So this is an eternal covenant that can never change, can never stop, this covenant with Abraham. This is why Paul talks about that we're Abraham's seed. All right? And again, Abraham's seed are the ones that have the same faith as Abraham. What was Abraham's faith? When God said, "Leave your house, leave your father, leave your family," what did he do? He said, "No, I'll think about it." Early the next day, he's gone. That's Abraham's faith. His faith is so strong, it produces an action. That's the faith of Abraham.
And here's the thing I was thinking, like, is he not believe in the word of God? So you see, from the beginning to end, it was always about Yeshua.
It always is. He's the word. Yes. That's right. The word told him to do something. He believed the word. And we have our English idea of believe is just a mind thing. It's esoterical. In Hebrew thinking, you will do what you believe. And if you don't do it, then you don't really believe it. It has to produce an action. James, really read here, it says, and when he says, "Faith without works is dead." He says, you have faith? Can your faith save you? He says, not without works. It can't. Because it hasn't manifested in a physical way. So this whole idea of him making this covenant with Abraham is critical that Abraham's asleep. Because man always messes up covenants. Because we're flesh. And the flesh tends to take over for us. Okay. Now we're going to take a quick look at Ezekiel 37. Hopefully this all ties in and makes sense in the end. Everybody's probably familiar with this. This is the dry bones. All right. We're talking about Ezekiel, and he's told to prophesy over the dry bones. I'm trying to figure out where I should start here. Verse 11 mentions, he says, "Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel." So again, this book is always about Israel. This is why it's really important that we come into covenant with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We come to the understanding that when we come into that covenant, we're now Israelites. Nothing else, we become Israel, because that's what this book is concentrated on. So if we want to be part of this book, we've got to be part of Israel. So what we've got here is these bones that he's going to speak to are the whole house of Israel, the unified 12 tribes. They indeed say, "Our bones are dry, our hope is lost, and we ourselves are cut off." This refers again to that divorce. Mm-hmm. Okay? These are the northern 10 tribes. They're cut off. They got no way back because of the law. Therefore, prophesy and say to them, "Thus says Jehovah Elohim, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and I will cause you to come up from your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. Then you shall know that I am Jehovah when I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought you up from your graves. I will put my spirit in you and you shall live, and I will place you in your own land. Then you shall know that I, Jehovah, have spoken it and performed it, says Jehovah." Verse 15. "Again, the word of Jehovah came to me, saying, as for you, son of man, take a stick for yourself and write on it, for Judah and the children of Israel, his company, and take another stick and write on it for Joseph and the stick of Ephraim and for all the house of Israel and his company. Then join them one to another, for yourself into one stick, and they shall become one in your hand. Then the children of your people speak to you, saying, will you not show us what you mean by these?" And this is interesting because this, who's always referred to as the Son of Man?
Yeshua.
So in Yeshua's hands, he's going to take the southern tribes and the northern tribes, and he's going to make them one stick again. So this divided kingdom that we have through man's sin, Yeshua is going to join those two tribes, those two houses, back together in one unified kingdom. Hasn't done that yet. This still is taking place today. We're just starting to wake up and understand who we are in all of this. Mm-hmm. So when he restores us back to Judah and Ephraim together as one stick, we're going to be that reunited house of Israel, all 12 tribes joined together. Because in Revelation, how many gates are in that city? 12 gates. And it's all the 12 tribes of Israel.
Restored.
Is there a Gentile gate? No, there is not. Guess what? Because Gentile means out of covenant. Only covenant people are going to go through those gates. And they're part of Israel. Yes.
I was going to say, like, this is also connected to the parable of Yeshua about the prodigal son. Mm-hmm.
It is.
We're going to get to that, actually.
Now we're Israelites, we're living among swines and we're tired. We just want to go home.
Exactly. Exactly. And how do they go home, John? Do they go home saying, "Judah, you got the dates all wrong. Judah, you got this wrong. Judah, you're doing that all wrong. And all those traditions you do, man, you're over the top." No. How do we go back? We go home and say, you know what? I'll just be a servant because it's better in my father's house as a servant than with the swine.
That's right.
Humbly, which is the way it should be done. We got a lot to learn yet because there's still a lot of animosity and there's still a lot of I know better than you going on with big brother Judah. So we're going to learn that. I'm going to go a little bit further in Ezekiel 37 here. Let me see, 19. Say to them, thus says Jehovah Elohim, surely I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will join them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand. And it just keeps on going. So again, it's this whole idea of the reunited houses of Israel brought together. Right now, the two houses, which we have right now, is a curse because of our disobedience and our sin. That's not the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be united. So when Yeshua's mission and job is to reunite these two houses together, that's what he came here to do. So we need to get in line with his mission and help him complete that, which is reuniting these two tribes, these two houses back together.
So trying to say, oh, I'm the Ephraimite, you know, when you're pegging yourself to be separate, to be that northern kingdom, yes, we are, but that's not the plan. Let's plan on the restored house. Everybody said, are you one house or two house? No, we're the restored house.
Exactly. There are two houses right now. But that's not the ideal situation. That's the curse.
We want the same mandate as Yeshua.
In Mark 3:24, it says, Yeshua says, if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. So he's kind of referring again, what he's going to do, he's going to reunite this kingdom so it can stand. Romans 11:26, and so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Sion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. Jacob again represents the whole 12 tribes. Okay? So this comes to the whole idea of the gospel of the kingdom. So what we've got here is we've got the historical background. What happened to the kingdom of Israel? Through their sin, they get divided into two houses. We can't have that. They have to be reunited, and they have to be one house. They end up, through their sin, getting divorced, which again, that's really going to keep them out of this oneness idea, isn't it? They're not going to be able to come back. So, Yeshua is going to remedy this situation. Who did Yeshua come for? Anybody know the scripture verse?
Lost sheep of Israel.
Matthew 15:24 says, the only people Yeshua came for. Let's check it out. Matthew 15:24. Yeshua himself says, the Master, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Because you see, Judah didn't get divorced. There's a whole different situation going on there. The northern 10 tribes did get divorced. So he's come after those people. He's going to bring them, allow them to get back into this covenantal thing so they can be reunited with the whole house of Israel. This is kind of interesting too. I wanted to put a few verses down that refers to Yeshua as the bridegroom. And you know, that's something we all kind of probably already understand, but I wanted to put some verses down so we had some scriptural references for that. And I've got three of them right there. So you can check those up on your own. Matthew 9:15, Mark 2:19, and Luke 5:34. There's others, but I just picked a handful because I like to have at least two witnesses. So anyways, those refer to Yeshua as our bridegroom. So now we're going to talk about this mystery that Rav Shul or Paul is referring to. In Romans chapter 7, I love it that you got to go through all the scripture kind of beginning to end to get this whole story played out. We're not just stuck in the Renewed Covenant or the Brit Hadashah. We're all over the map. Romans chapter 7. And this one used to confuse me to no end until I understood the two houses and the gospel of the kingdom. And it just makes perfect sense. I'll read this to you. Chapter 7 of Romans, verse 1. Or do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the Torah. First off, if you don't know the Torah, don't read Romans chapter 7. It's only going to confuse you. You should know the Torah, because when Paul wrote this, What was the only scriptures that existed? Or when he spoke this, I should say.
Tanakh.
The Tanakh. We didn't have a New Testament. Didn't exist. Right? Until like 300 years later. So, he's referring to the Tanakh when he says, listen, you guys got to understand that or you're not going to get this thing. So
he's
in other
talking
words,
specifically of Deuteronomy 24.
This is Deuteronomy 24 he's referring to here. This is the law he's speaking about. Everybody likes to think that Yeshua died for all sin. Well, no. He died for one specific sin. He says he came for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. What was their sin? Spiritual adultery. They got themselves divorced. He died for that one so that they could come back into play. Okay? So it says that law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. So the Torah has dominion over a man as long as he lives. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law. Deuteronomy 24. So that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. Therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law, Deuteronomy 24, through the body of Messiah, that you may be married to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that you should bear fruit to God. This is why Yeshua had to die and be raised up. Because he is our bridegroom, he is the husband we're to marry, and we can't remarry the original husband because of the divorce. He has to die, which nullifies that law.
And
he raised a new man. So it circumvents that law. It actually fulfills that law, if you want to use that term. So he allows that northern 10 tribes to come back into the covenant and be reunited with Israel and married back in again. This is the gospel of the kingdom. This is why when Yeshua was out preaching, and more importantly later on when Paul was out preaching, he only went to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Because they grabbed this thing. Because they knew they were without hope, without God, because of their sin. And Judah was more than happy to tell them, you guys are out, you're never coming back. There still are people in Judah that think that way. It's called the House of Shammai teaching. And they will not let us back in. They think you guys have been divorced, you're gone, you never come back. They don't understand the job and the role of the Messiah when he came the first time as that suffering servant. So he died so they could come back in. Does this kind of make sense?
Messiah ben Yosef.
Messiah ben Yosef. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is everybody kind of tracking with this? Are we following this okay?
Some people are looking confused. Is that a question?
I was going to say,
No.
I was yes. going to say, like, that is the reason why a lot of people misunderstand, like, Paul's letters, his epistles. Like, I actually, like, went and checked because I know next week. You're going to talk. So I actually find like all the verses, Christian says the law been done away with.
Yeah.
And why? And I like we went back to that and studied them. Like for example, you can go to Colossians 2:14.
Yep.
This is one of them. They say like having plotted out the bond written in the ordinance that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he had taken it out of the way, nailed it to the cross. Everybody's like, you see right there, the law is nailed to the cross.
Which law?
Which law?
Mm-hmm. That's the question.
Specifically, ordinance. Mm-hmm. If you understand, the Torah is the light. Mm-hmm. Okay? The commandment is the lamb. The ordinance is a declaration or the details on the lamb.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what he says specific to Deuteronomy 24.
Exactly.
He's talking about that specific under the commandment of marriage. After divorce, there is small section B by the law. It says if you're divorced, you cannot no longer marry the one you married before.
That's right.
And this is the one he nailed it to the cross. You know what happened after you nailed it to a cross? He died and then resurrect again. Mm-hmm. Redo all over again. You are free to remarry, but if you marry again, you will be bound by this Torah again. That is said in Hebrews 6.
That's right.
I should write them all down. So
well,
you know.
Actually, this one is that it's the penalty has been nailed to the cross, not actually the law.
And
but the penalty of the law, because we were divorced, we deserve that penalty. But
He took that penalty for us.
Yeshua took it on for us. He even drank the bitter water and the whole thing.
Yeah,
it gets
really deep in all the things.
Because he's raised as a new man,
yes,
we're no longer bound to the old law, and we can come back in the covenant.
Which really, it even ties into the new covenant. And I don't like using the term new covenant because it's not new. It's the same covenant. It's been renewed. Mm-hmm. If you look up what that word new means, it actually means repaired or rebuilt. And we're going to find out, we're going to read that right now. Anybody know where the new covenant is first given?
Take a guess.
Well, you're right. That is the covenant, but when it's first renewed. Anybody?
Jeremiah
31. You got it. It's reiterated in Hebrews 8. Most Christians will go right to Hebrews 8. They don't realize it's already been done in Jeremiah 31. So let's go to Jeremiah 31 and just kind of read this slowly, this new covenant, a renewed covenant idea, and see if we can't see how it meshes in with what we've been discussing about this, these two kingdoms and this divorce and coming back in. Jeremiah 31, 31. Behold, the days are coming, says Jehovah, when I will make a renewed covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And I've had Christian friends of mine I discuss this with, so I'll ask them, do you see Gentiles in there anywhere? No, it's with Israel and Judah. Okay? Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand and led them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them, says Jehovah. See the terminology being played out here. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Jehovah. I will put my Torah in their minds and write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. No more shall every man teach his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know Jehovah. For all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, says Jehovah. For I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I shall remember no more. Has that happened yet?
Nope.
Does everybody out there know God? No, they do not. This has yet to happen. When Yeshua came, he started this thing off. But when he returns, he's going to complete it. And this is going to take place. So this new covenant idea hasn't happened yet. Okay? We have the ability to enter into this now through Yeshua's offering. But this completion has not taken place yet. Okay? Does that make sense?
I'm going to take them to Hebrews 8:8.
Well, Hebrews 8:8 is just, it's a quote. The only problem is, and I do this, I'll check out in Hebrews 8:8, make sure the quote is quoted the same, because sometimes they change them. You got to be careful. And the thing that I really find amazing is where it says that he's going to write his Torah on their minds and write it on their hearts. In Hebrews 8:8, if you look up the word law in the Greek, it's some big, long, esoterical nonsense. But back here in Jeremiah, you look up law, it says Torah. How did it change from a direct quote from the Greek to some long, esoterical, weird thing to Torah? I don't know how that happened.
I think that's the language barrier. They don't have that word.
I think it is too.
No word for Torah.
But if we're going to be, honest, you know, it's the Torah written on their minds and their hearts.
Right.
Exactly.
Just a question. In 31, maybe you covered this already, but why did he have to make a new covenant with Israel and Judah?
Because Judah actually did break the covenant as well. Okay? So
they weren't divorced.
Yeah.
When we break a covenant, it has to be renewed, repaired, or rebuilt.
Okay.
Okay? And this is why God can't break a covenant. That's why his covenants, when he makes a covenant, it's eternal. That's right. And he can't change it. He has to work within the confines of what he's already established. If God's, if God says it, he has to do it. That's how I know, of all the religious books out there, this is the true one, because everything he says comes to pass. Mm-hmm. It has to.
Yeah.
All right? That's why everything Yeshua said came to pass, right? Why? Because he never said his own words. He only says the Father's words. And his Father's words always come to pass. The prophets, same thing. They never spoke their own words. They spoke the words that God told them to speak. So guess what? They came to pass. Mm-hmm. That's how we tell a false prophet. He's usually telling his own words. Mm-hmm. And they don't always come true. Sometimes they do. Those are the tricky ones. But, John?
I was going to say, like, and also there's a second witness about this. I mean, look at the law of gravity.
Hmm.
Do you think you can ever change that or alter that? Do you think God will ever change any of his law? And that's the thing. Like, if you can't change the law of gravity, it's the same. You cannot change the Torah. Because it's the same God created all this.
Yes.
Like, the witness is right there, you know. It's not, not we'll worship something we don't know. We know.
Let's hop over to kind of finish this thing off to Ephesians chapter 2, one of my favorite sections.
You say that about all the sections.
Well, I know, but this is it. It's all my favorite. Ephesians chapter 2, and I'm going to start in 2. We'll just keep reading, and you can see why what Paul's referring to here is exactly what we've been talking about tonight. Verse 1. And you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. And I find that little bit amazing because he has sons who are disobedient. Those ones you don't want to be. It's better to be somebody completely out of covenant than a son of disobedience, because the wrath is coming. Among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. But God, who is rich in mercy, because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses, made us alive together with Messiah. By grace you have been saved. And raised us up together and made us sit together in the heavenly places in Messiah Yeshua, that in the ages to come he might show the exceeding riches of his grace in his kindness toward us in Messiah Yeshua. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is a gift of God. So again, this whole gift of God, this grace he's given us, is that we are empowered now to come back into the covenant, which we can't on our own merit. He's the one that has to bring us back in. 9. Not of works, lest anyone should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua for good works. So once we're in Messiah, it's all about works from this point on, folks. Works don't get us in Messiah, but once we're in Messiah, it's all about works.
And that's why you say, if you love me, follow my commandments.
Keep my commandments, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. What are the works he prepared beforehand? The Torah, Mount Sinai, all over again. Verse 11, here's where things start to really reflect what we were discussing. Therefore, remember that you were once Gentiles. And whenever I see Gentiles, I always put out of covenant. Mm-hmm. Because that's what a Gentile is.
Because you could be from the house of Judah and be out of covenant, and then they'll call you a Gentile.
They call you a Gentile, right?
If you're not a practicing Jew, you're a Gentile.
That's why Paul also referred them as either uncircumcised or circumcised. Yeah,
that's right. You're either in or you're out. There's only two ways to go in this game. So remember that you were once Gentiles or out of covenant in the flesh, who were called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision made in the flesh by hands. That at that time, the time when you were out of covenant, at that time you were without Messiah, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Messiah Yeshua, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Messiah. So, when we are out of covenant, Gentiles, Goyim, dogs, uncircumcised, all the stuff they used to call them, unclean animals, when we come in through Messiah, we are now part of the commonwealth of Israel, with all covenants and all promises, which part of that is that land. That's the kingdom of heaven where we're headed, Israel. But we now, through Messiah, are part of that commonwealth.
I just wanted to point out with that verse there, where it says, those that are far off, if you do a scripture search, those that are far off are always the northern...
The lost sheep. They're always referred to as those...
Those that are brought, that are near are Judah, the southern...
Because they've always been there, around Jerusalem, around where God was residing. Okay? We'll keep going because it gets even nicer. For he himself is our peace, who has made both one, what do we read in Ezekiel 37? And has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so that to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace. So let's just kind of break this down for a second here. He has taken both. Again, we have the northern house and the southern house. He's taken both those and he's bringing them together as one. Okay? And he's abolished the enmity. What is the enmity? Is the hatred between the northern and southern tribes. Because if you read all of 1 Kings in about chapter 12 and 13, they actually were going to go to war with each other. So there's a hatred between the two of them. And this even comes into Yeshua's day in the first century. In the temple, they built a separation wall. It was a physical wall that kept the people separated. They couldn't worship together. And that's the enmity, the hatred that Yeshua nailed to the tree. So what do? We bring that anti-Semitism down. We bring that hatred for our brothers down. All the time. Why would we do that when he nailed it up there at a huge cost? He's trying to bring us both together as one unified nation. And this is why we're trying to get people to ease up on Judah a bit and let's try to become one. Because we've been separated long enough. Let's get on Yeshua's game plan. Let's start to honor our big brother just a little bit. And he might ease up on us and say, you know, these guys aren't so bad. Maybe we will allow them to come back in. And we'll start getting this ball rolling of unification, which is why Yeshua came. So he goes on to say, making peace between those two, that he might reconcile them both to God as one body. Mm-hmm. Through the tree, thereby putting to death the enmity or the hatred that divides us. And he came and preached peace to you who were far off and to those who were near. For through him, we both have access to one spirit, to the Father. Mm-hmm. And like John already said, remember the prodigal son, how are we to return? In humility and meekness. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting as well, because we even touched on this when Robert was talking about the fires in California. Yah's allowing this to happen. And it's our sin that causes these things to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay? But he's allowing it to happen to turn us back to him. And so he orchestrated this whole elaborate two-house idea from the very beginning, way back in Deuteronomy where we read they were gonna fail, all so he could reunite them through his son as one unified group. And that's kind of how this two-house thing works and what the gospel of the kingdom is, all kind of in a nutshell. So any questions or comments? Or
I was going to say, like, Ephesians 2:15 is going to be the one they're going to bring up and then tell you, like,
exactly.
But, like, if you read again, he is talking about two things.
Yep.
One is to put in the two stick as one. The second one is the mystery of gospel. Again, he's talking about, he said, even the law of commandments contained in the ordinance.
Yes.
Is it that small thing? It's keeping us, cannot remarry back again. Mm-hmm. That is what Christ has done for us. Taking that, you know, how do you say it?
He's fulfilled it.
Yes.
He's fulfilled that law.
That does not go away. That's what people keep thinking. That's right. Oh, it go away. I'll give you a verse why it doesn't go away.